Hello, listeners. Excuse the background noise of this intro. I am, in fact, recording from a very loud house because there is a Thanksgiving celebration downstairs. Regardless, this is a very special episode. Today we're talking and interviewing Lianyu Tan, the author of The Wicked and the Willing, a really, really interesting horror romance story, and it's got vampires, so I, of course, loved it. So please join us for this really, really fun discussion as I try to edit out the background noise of this intro. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone!
Welcome to In Media Les, a podcast about queer relationships in media. I'm Chloe.
And I'm Val. And actually, in this episode, we have a very, very special guest with us, Lianyu Tan.
Oh, thank you so much, Chloe and Val, for having me on. So I am an indie author. The Wicked and the Willing is my second book. It is a sapphic vampire gothic horror novel. Thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, of course.
So I have to admit, like all good procrastinators, I didn't start reading the book until last night. And then I started it at like 6 p.m. And then next thing I knew, it was like 9 p.m. and I was 250 pages in. This book is really, really, I don't want to use the term easy to read because it is dealing with some very significant subject matter and at parts, like I was kind of like, oh my God, you know, like I had this visceral reaction to what was happening on the pages. But this book is a really excellent read and I feel like I was really enraptured by it. And I was hoping you could talk about, as someone who does not have that creative writing background like Val does, what is your writing process like in terms of how do you get this into this format where it's both dealing with this very significant and difficult subject matter, but also like, it's very compelling and it's a page turner. You want to read the next page because you want to know what happens next. How do you balance that?
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so glad that it was engaging. So, I mean, I come from fanfic.
Heck yes.
But I really like there's this book called Sean Coyne's Story Grid Method, and it's about story structure and how to edit your books. And I personally find that really speaks to me because I'm really a spreadsheet gal and that book has a lot of spreadsheets in it. So I guess, you know, not all authors are into that, but I personally am. You know, just to have the structure of a bad thing is about to happen and, you know, you want to kind of keep reading to see how bad it gets. But at this book, it took me 15 months from the start of researching it to publication, and that was,
oh, that's quick.
Too short. Yeah, it really was too short a time frame. I kind of regret it a little bit now, but sort of that is the pressure as an indie author that you have to sort of feed the algorithm, put it out. I've later found this does not work for me and my process personally, but this is what I did with this book, so that's how that happened. But the research, like, I'm really lucky to live near a really good research university that allows public access to their library, so I just got out a bunch of books. I really haven't researched the Singapore community and the Straits Settlement before, even though I am Malaysian Chinese, that's my background, but my family immigrated to Australia when I was a young child, so I feel quite disconnected from the culture, and it's really a hard decision picking up a project like this because you do feel as a diasporic author that you know should someone else be telling this story? Is it really kosher these days?
That's always the question, yeah.
Yeah, it is hard, I think. I do worry that I've misrepresented things poorly. But I did have a lot of sensitivity readers, and they helped a lot.
Well, I think they definitely did their job. As someone who was in a lot of places with people who wrote a lot of books and stories and just exposed to that, a lot of them were not great, I will say. And sometimes it was very difficult reading people's stories because it wasn't sensitive. Not to say that this book takes things lightly or pulls back the punches very often, but there is a sense of responsibility there that a lot of times I didn't experience while in school. And yeah, it's a really difficult tightrope to walk, I think. Actually, at first, before reading the excerpt that you sent me, I was a little cautious. But then once I got through it, you can immediately tell that there is care in the words. Yeah, it was really fun reading it. I really enjoyed it.
I was hoping, along with that, you know, you're talking about the sensitivity element. And I was curious, like, you know, you mentioned both at the end of the book, and then I think in your email to us, you mentioned that a lot of this was inspired by Seth Dickinson's The Trader Baru Cormorant, which is one of my favorites. And I was just wondering if you could speak about how that inspired you, and then how you drew upon that when writing this book, and what are the through lines that you see as the author between Baru and this book?
Oh, absolutely. Oh my gosh, I'd love to talk about Baru so much. Yeah, the Trader Baru Cormorant and the subsequent books are just some of my favorites. Actually, my wife has been telling me for years, you know, Lian Yu, you're autistic. And, you know, I was like, oh, I don't know. I've got such great coping mechanisms. I can't possibly be. But then, you know, I was reading the reviews for Trader, and a lot of the reviews are like, as an autistic lesbian, I really relate to Baru. And I was like, oh dear, I really relate to Baru too. So, so obviously Baru is a colonized, subject in a secondary fantasy world, and she, you know, she has this idea of overthrowing the evil empire. And it's very epic in scope there. So at the end of Tyrant, which I only finished reading for the first time a couple years ago, my brain did a thing where it hasn't done this before, but it was just keeping me up at 3 a.m. with all the racial microaggressions I've experienced in my life. And I think it's because, you know, with Baru, it's so obvious to see when people having micro and macroaggressions against her as a colonized subject who is, you know, dark brown skinned and a lesbian and all that, mm-hmm. That comes with it. So it's sort of, it's so much easier to see these problems when someone else is experiencing it and a fictional character is experiencing it and it doesn't have that real world baggage, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, so I was at that point and I had a decision. I could either try to seek another therapist and sort this out in therapy, which is, you know, a totally valid choice if you can access that.
It's very expensive.
Yeah, I totally support people, you know, you should do therapy if you feel you need it and you have the resources, whatever. And there's always a lot of free options, but, you know, that wasn't suitable for me. I was like, oh, I might as well write this book. And I had been thinking about, you know, vampires and colonialism for quite a while, but I was just really reluctant to pick it up because, one, I thought it's going to have an unhappy ending and people don't like those. It's not marketable. So I was really reluctant for that reason, and also because I knew it would need a lot of research to be done, and I'm fundamentally lazy, so I was reluctant to do that.
That's fair. But
I just really felt that I had all these feelings that I had to get out, and I'm kind of like a very slow writer, and it just took 120,000 words to get them out.
I'm going to ask one more follow-up question, and then I'll let Val ask a question.
Yeah,
I promise.
Sitting on my hands, yes. About.
So one thing I was curious about, because Baru was an inspiration, but I feel like one of the important differences here is that Baru is set, it's a fictional world. You know, it's a low fantasy world, but it's fundamentally, and it's got some inspirations, obviously, from our world, from the Atlantic trade routes and whatnot. Seems to be a big inspiration, but it is fundamentally a world that is completely different from our own, whereas, you know, The Wicked and the Willing is set in Singapore in the 1920s. And I was wondering what made you choose between, say, like, a fictional setting for this therapeutic outlet versus choosing to use the real world?
Oh, you know, the project that I trashed just before I started writing on this one was a secondary world fantasy. I was 70,000 words into it, and it just wasn't working out for me, and I just decided, you know, my skill set's not there yet, and I'm going to shelve this for now. So in some ways, the real world is both more difficult and easier because you can get real answers like, how long is the train from Johor Bahru to Bangkok? Was there a train line, you know, in the city? And that sort of thing. So you can, you don't have to make it up. And sometimes that's easier.
That's fair, yeah. And I think very often with stories that have like supernatural element that is caked into a culture or a society, it's much easier to have the tie to the real world, at least for readers to conceptualize. I don't know if you agree with that. But like with Bahru, it's easy to be in a fake world because everything is very different culturally. Whereas in this story, if it was to be in a fantastical made-up world, I think it still needed to have the aspects of history that it did. And I find myself kind of spacing out when books do that a lot. Chloe already knows, but I'm always a fan of very, like, unhinged characters.
Yeah.
And I think while Verity definitely took the first place when it comes to that here, I found that Gyeongchu is actually very unsettling in a lot of scenes. Was that on purpose? Was that something that you set out to do? Because very often she feels like she's in situations that she definitely doesn't have control over. But while she's afraid, it feels more like she's excited by the danger and less so afraid to be in it. Like, there are quite a few scenes where I thought that she wasn't afraid at all, even though on the page the characters might think that she is. Is that something that's intentional?
Well, I think Gyeongchu partly came because before or while I was writing this, I read two very much more popular, well-known gothic horror / paranormal novels, and they both happened to have female protagonists. And during the last act, both those protagonists have a pretty graphic scene where they almost get raped, but it doesn't happen. And none of those were content warnings, but, you know, publishers often don't do that. It might not be the author's choice, whatever. I support authors including whatever in their books. Like, I don't want to call these books out or anything because it's not about the individual book, right? It's about the pattern in horror. You know, the final girl has to be a virgin. Why does she have to be a virgin? Because she's not valuable otherwise. And, you know, virginity is such a social construct. It has no meaning outside of what power we give it. So I really wanted to have a character who, I guess this is a spoiler, but anyway, you know, who is definitely not a virgin at the start of the book, who is sexually assaulted multiple times. That's probably not a great example, but I mean, of the sort of anti-final girl. But it's just that I think the sort of horror trope of, you know, you need to be pure to escape the villain or have agency or to save yourself. If you're not pure, then you can't save yourself. A man has to do it for you. Or even if it's a woman doing it for you, it's not great, I think, as a message. So she was meant to be not that thing. And I think I often feel a bit sorry for her because I feel like sometimes readers don't value her agency in the ways she's able to express it, because she is a teenage girl who is beautiful and that gives her some power over the characters in her lives. And she does choose to, say, dress in a filmy nightdress to see Polam, for instance, because she knows she needs someone to look out for her and to protect her in the ways that she can't protect herself. And that is a choice that she's making to exercise what power she does have. And that's a power that we don't value, that we don't like teenage girls to realize that they are beautiful or have any control or anything. And it's, you know, obviously it's not something they can necessarily control. It's not something they ask for. It's all messed up.
Yeah.
I don't think we are very nice to teenage girls in society.
What? No way. But yeah, it definitely felt like she was orchestrating a space for herself in that home. It was really fun reading that, like those sections where there's supposed to be a power imbalance, but very clearly it's not as much as the others would seem to believe there is. Yeah, I was just really curious about that. because once again, it's a fairly taboo topic outside of, you know, maybe romance novels, and even there as well. So it's very interesting how you used it. I quite enjoyed those scenes where she just very slightly changes the outcome of a conversation. It was very interesting because I think she's quite a good manipulator, and it doesn't have to be like a negative quality to a person, but it also wasn't always a positive quality in this book. It's really interesting. I really like the somewhat gray morality of quite a few of the characters here.
Oh, thank you so much for picking it up. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know that we've talked about the inspiration from like Baru and such, but I also found that there's quite a lot from, I know Dracula was mentioned, but Carmilla. How much of that, did the story of Carmilla in any way kind of give you this idea? Because I saw so many like, not parallels necessarily, but just, and I know the vampire aspect of it is fairly tropey, but there is a lot with Carmilla there that I found to be very closely related to the story.
Oh, absolutely. Genshu quotes Carmilla, and Verity mentions that there's some favorite passages that she loves. So, I mean, the thing about Carmilla is that Laura both is fascinated by her and deeply repulsed by her. Mm-hmm. When I was writing this, I was thinking about rereading Carmilla, but I actually just read S.D. Simper's, she's another indie author, retelling of Carmilla called, I think it's Carmilla and Laura, which rewrites it with a happy ending. It's quite true to the original in that Laura is still vaguely disgusted by Carmilla. And I do love that contrast, you know, that you can love and want someone and still be horrified by them. It is probably problematic. I mean, I think my sort of author's subtitle should be something like problematic. Maybe that would give people a better idea of what they're in for. I really don't like to push this book because, you know, this book really wants to hurt you as a reader. Mm-hmm. And not everyone is open to that, which is fine.
Yeah, I can see that. There were some stories that I wrote in school that I was, you know, not necessarily not excited to bring to class and discuss, but was like mentally blocking myself off from like whatever critique I might receive on it. So I completely understand. It's a different sort of like excitement for your work. I don't know, Chloe, yeah. I've been kind of stealing the conversation.
While we were connecting this to other work, it's going to be a very goofy one. And I just wanted to know if you had heard of it. Because I don't know, you might even like be like, oh my God, this stupid American when I say this. But have you read the book Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter?
I have not yet.
Do you know of it? Okay. So I'm not talking about the part where a president of the United States kills a bunch of vampires.
Why not?
Although that part is very good. But it's actually the idea of like presenting the ruling class, the racist ruling class of white people as vampires is actually something that happens in that book. In that case, it's set in the American South immediately prior to the Civil War. And so you've got all the slave plantation owners depicted as vampires. And I don't know, I guess the connection to me here was just, yeah, it's just like, it makes sense. This idea of like presenting the colonizers and the slave owners and the powerful forces of either landed gentry or capitalism or whatever you want to call it, as literal blood-sucking monsters made a lot of sense to me. So I was just curious if you had ever read that book, but...
Oh, no, I haven't. But it just makes so much sense, doesn't it? Because, yeah. You know, capitalism wants to constantly expand. And to expand, you've got to find new territories. And they're usually occupied, so what are you going to do there? I mean, it's crazy because at the end of World War One, I mean, the British Empire covered like 25% almost... Well, not quite a quarter, a bit less than a quarter of the world's sort of land area and the world's people. And that's 1 in 4 people. That's insane.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, that wasn't really a question. I just wanted to make that connection. I feel like we haven't mentioned directly the vampire in the room, which is Verity. Edivane? How would you pronounce it?
It's Edivane in the audiobook.
Okay. Yeah. I should check that out. Okay. I think what's curious about her to me is that she's presented, you start by presenting her almost in kind of a sympathetic light. Like when Guillaume first meets her, she's very, very frail. She's abstaining from blood and she's not taking thralls like the other vampires. But then I feel like as the book continues, you realize she's just as bad, if not worse, than many of the other vampires. And now that I'm thinking about that, but then she also like feeds that first night and does, you know, kill that sex worker. So it's interesting to me that she's both presented as very frail at the start, but then also is very deadly. And I was wondering if you could talk more about the process, I guess in general, just developing Verity as a character and how you imagined her when you were writing the book.
Right. So I guess the starting image I had for this book was, you know, Verity on the staircase in a really beautiful gown. It was originally meant to be Victorian because I have a thing for like big skirts. It's just very dramatic and pretty. So I moved the timeline up just to suit some of the other character aspects. But, you know, it's about the contrast between her from the start and the end. Obviously, when you present like a weak invalid, it arouses a certain kind of sympathy in a protagonist who is the reader by, and it's just to have that contrast between what she becomes, lets herself become later on. And I think, you know, we often assume that vampires are always stronger than humans, and certainly, you know, there's a lot of that trope in here as well later on, but I guess it could possibly have been calculated on her part as well to arouse sympathy. But yeah, I really just wanted to have that, the contrast and the change.
Interesting.
Well, we start off with Poe being kind of very distant and cold emotionally, and Verity being very kind of accessible, but violent and wicked. And I think it's an extremely prevalent trope in stories like these, be it queer, be it not queer. And what was the consideration for the usage of tropes? Because in the end, this is a supernatural romance and it has a lot of tropes, and I've always been a fan of them. They're shorthand for readers. They're not easy to write for writers necessarily, but I feel like they are an outline for us to work with. And just how much consideration did you give to that? Or was it just a natural part of the process?
I think that's hard to think about. I guess by the time I came to this book, I was more writing to please myself because I didn't think this would be a terribly popular text, and I was right. This book will probably never earn out its sort of publishing costs. It is much less popular than my other novel, which is a Hades Persephone retelling, even though I think this is the better book and more meaningful, but you know, you can't control the market, right? So I just chucked in tropes that I wanted to see. I wanted to see an abuser who doesn't repent, you know, who actually is terrible. And the text doesn't try to apologize for her, I hope.
Don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, she's just, you know, she obviously thinks that she is better than the other vampires, that she's more moral, that she's trying harder. And she believes that she genuinely has offered opportunities to these poor, impoverished women that she takes under her wing and eventually usually kills. But I didn't really want to sugarcoat that at all. I really think we have the bury your gaze, you know, and the issue of rep, what is good rep, what is sufficient rep. And I just wanted to see a queer woman who has power, who uses it, who is awful, who does awful things. That's really fair. Where it's come from. Yeah. Because I don't really see that very often in media these days, because I think, you know, we worry about, is this going to make people think that, oh, all queer white people are terrible? I don't know.
Well, I don't know. We are from time to time, but I don't think we're at that level.
That's good to know, Val. Good to know you're not quite at the level of vampire colonist.
Yeah. Okay.
Jeez. Saturday night. Mike, you include some other vampires in here as well. You know, we have Daphne, who I got the implication that Daphne is supposed to be trans. I think that's probably the accurate reading there. Mm-hmm. And as well, we've got Poe, who maybe is not trans, but definitely has some like non-binary characteristics. And I was wondering if you could talk about how you thought about the gender of the characters as you were writing the book.
I think, you know, in historical settings, it's much easier for some people to fly on the radar a little bit with their gender presentation, in terms of you have less, you know, identification checkpoints. You can sort of disappear into a different setting. Obviously, if you're moving from, you know, England to a very remote colony on the other side of the world, you can really reinvent your whole life a little bit. Bolam's masculinity was partly a response to Verity as the ultra high femme, you know, just to have that contrast, and also to make her, this is going to sound pretty bad, I guess, to make her doubt herself a little bit, to make her not fit in to society as much, and to sort of have another reason to stick with Verity as someone who doesn't care about her gender presentation, or, you know, she's not going to be forced to look a certain way, or it sort of binds her a little bit more to that household, knowing that she's not going to be forced to be married or do things she doesn't want to do.
I like that answer.
Yeah, interesting. I was wondering also for Daphne, whether that was a character you imagined early on, or was that something like you needed to fill with more vampires and that idea came up? I was just curious because I found her to be a very interesting character, that we get these hints that, you know, that she actually is maybe one of the more ethical ones, I guess, of these unethical monsters. And I was curious about her as a character.
And maybe even slightly more powerful than Verity.
Yeah.
She definitely had more sway in society, in the vampire society.
Yeah, I think Daphne is definitely more careful than Verity. She fits in better. She plays the game better. And I think she wasn't originally meant to be trans, but one of my sensitivity readers did mention that, you know, Bolam is carrying a lot of the gender non-binary flag a little bit, and you should try to have some other characters who are, you know, not conforming. So that's how that happened. So I'm grateful for that comment anyway. I think it did improve by having Daphne be trans. I think she does fit in a little better, and the vampire society is more concerned, I think, about race rather than gender presentation.
And why do you think that is? So, like, you know, like one of the themes, I guess, in Baru, and, you know, I don't know if you've read Seth Dickinson's blog, but he has this very famous blog post called The Secret Design of Baru. And one of the things he talks about there is that in a lot of, you know, kind of imperialist societies, is that any kind of nonconformity has to be crushed. And he talks about that both in terms of, you know, sexuality and gender, as well as race. So I'm curious why there's this distinction here where this vampiric society is so racist, but seemingly okay with the fact, you know, I think Daphne obviously, but also Verity mentions to, I forget the head honcho whose name I'm going to totally space
starts
on.
Starts
with a K.
Karen.
Karen. Well, sorry, what was it?
Callum.
Callum,
thank you.
Mentions to him that she at least she uses an old-fashioned word, but she basically mentions that she's a lesbian to him, and he's fine with it. So I was curious about, I don't know, just how you think, that was like kind of a speech designed as a question, I apologize, but I was curious how you reconcile the racism versus, you know, them being more accepting of sexuality and gender.
Yeah, it could have gone either way, but I was really, I really wanted at the start to not have the sort of historical setting homophobia that would have existed. And that was a conscious choice not to feature that, even though it would have been historically accurate. The English were very concerned about the brothels in Singapore, and partly because they were concerned about their men sleeping with Asian men. And that aspect of it, they did end up shutting down a lot of brothels. The Japanese ones were already shut down by the time this book starts, but they progressively, you know, made the rest of them illegal eventually. But I really didn't want to put homophobia in because there's so much other stuff in it already. It was just like, oh gosh, it's just, it's a lot, I think, for the reader, for the queer reader to have to deal with. So, you know, one of those ways was to not make the vampires that homophobic, even though they could have been. And I mean, partly gender control is about reproduction and, you know, ensuring mm-hmm. your family is who you think it is, and controlling women's sexuality so you can be sure that your offspring are your own offspring. And obviously vampires don't have children that way. I mean, that's the inherently queer part of vampires, right? You can buy anyone and you can turn anyone, regardless of your gender or their gender. Whereas the race thing is like, well, one of the things I sort of regret not highlighting is that Verity would never have gotten approval to make Genchu a vampire because she's not white. And that would have been a sticking point mm-hmm. for this particular society. I'm not sure if that comes across, but it's...
I got that vibe. Yeah, that to me was pretty clear.
Yeah, because when you're immortal, like, you know, those choices last forever. So it's a big deal.
We've talked a little bit about your inspirations, but is there anything in, like, the horror genre that specifically drew you to this sort of theme? Is there like, a book that maybe isn't prevalent, but just has, like, a detail or two that you really, really liked that maybe solidified this idea for you?
I'm really not sure because, you know, what I really felt reading horror was the lack of this vibe, as particularly in sapphic context. You know, dark romance, modern dark romance as a genre has been around for at least 10 years. Kitty Thomas's comfort food is sort of cited as the precursor to modern dark romance. So we have a lot of het and gay, so MM, dark romance where the romance option is abusive and toxic and terrible, and that is the trope. That is what readers are asking for. But it's only been very recently that sapphic titles have been coming out using that marketing term and dipping into those tropes, probably not quite as darkly as this one. I haven't really kept up with the genre, I have to admit. But I just, you know, I really wanted a sapphic villain who was powerful and desirable, and Genchu does genuinely desire her. And I wanted to see if I could make readers fall in love with her.
mm-hmm.
So that was kind of the challenge, even though she's pretty awful.
I think I was asking the question because one of my favorite books is A Haunting of Hill House.
I knew it. I was like, She's digging for that Hill House.
I'm fishing.
Yeah.
And I think it was just the isolation of a very empty mansion, and the people in there leave for the night. No one stays, and those who stay are part of the madness. And I think it's a fairly common theme in a lot of horror that doesn't necessarily have to do with, you know, with queerness, but very often, surprisingly, it does. I think the isolation of the characters, be it in a literal house on the hill. I don't know if you read Passing. It's not necessarily a horror, but it has quite a few themes that have to do with queerness, despite it being a book that is about race, about passing as a white person, but not being a white person, and the weight and guilt that carries and the danger it carries, and how it ruins your relationships. But it also has a lot of, I found that a lot of themes from passing also make it across. So it's very interesting how all of these genres that have this kernel of queerness in it very often use isolation to aid in it. Was that something that you experienced or maybe put in there on purpose? Or is it, a tool of the trade that was helpful with the setting?
Oh, so I haven't read Passing. I have read
Haunting. You should. It's really, really good.
I have to look it up. I read A Haunting of Hill House after I finished this book, and after I watched the Netflix show first. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize it would be so different. But I mean, isolation is such a key part of gothic horror, because you do have to, you know, make the protagonists depend on their whatever.
The Stockholm.
Yeah, the demon lover. Kidnapper. Yeah. So, yeah, the isolation is a really big part of that. I think a lot of this is, well, Genchu and Polam are both, you know, they weren't born in the Straits. They are outsiders, just as Verity is. And that's something I've always really felt. And I felt like it's something I'm not allowed to talk about and not even allowed to think about. I think the first time I really had to think about it is, have you guys played Dragon Age Inquisition?
Of course, yes. hundreds of hours.
I tried.
Well, in there's a elf mage, Solas, who is
Solas.
He clearly doesn't fit in with the stereotypical elf background. Like, he doesn't have the tattoos
the
of the Dalish.
Yes. Yeah, that's the bald dude.
Okay.
That's him. Yeah, so he's not the correct kind of elf, but he will tell you as the elven protagonist, if you choose to be an elf, that, you know, you're not elvish enough, you're not doing it right, you're not pronouncing the language properly. He will be a horrible ass to you, basically.
He's a real jerk.
Yeah, and I found that so triggering, and I was like, oh gosh, I've got stuff I need to work on, you know, as a 20-something, that I was old woman at the time. So there was that, and then there was also Barrow, so triggering. I find the things that trigger me, that no one ever content warns for them. So I think that content warnings are necessary, but not sufficient as a reader or interactor with fiction. Anyway, that's a whole other conversation. But, you know, so the isolation thing is, you know, I've always felt, because I am monolingual, I wasn't born monolingual, I guess, you know, the language was bullied out of me. And I've always felt very inferior to other, you know, Asian Australians. I kind of find it more in commonality with, Asian Americans sometimes. I think the stories are very similar. There's, this memoir, Tastes Like War, by Grace M. Cho. She's Korean American. That I was like, oh my gosh, there's so many things we share in common, even though we're different generations and backgrounds and all that. So the isolation is a really big part of that. When I grew up, my family was like the only non-white family in this small rural Australian town. Not the best way to grow up. And you really feel like the only way to be a good girl is to be a beautiful girl. And the only way to be a beautiful girl is to be a beautiful white girl. And I realize that beauty standards apply to everyone, right? No matter what your race. And it's unattainable for anyone, right? Mm-hmm. So it's bad for everyone. But yeah. So I have a lot of hang-ups. I put them in this book. That's why I think it's not something I necessarily want people to have to experience, because, you know, it's not very nice, I guess.
So, your hang-ups are very palatable in this book.
So I just wanted to mention, I've actually met Grace M. Cho very briefly, but she's faculty at the CUNY Graduate Center, and I was a student there for a couple of years, so I've met her.
Wow, that's so cool.
Like, a long time ago, and it was not like a very long meet, but I do remember her. Vaguely. So, yeah. She's from our neck of the woods, Val. Yeah.
I've met people, I have no memory of any of them.
This is definitely one of those things where I was like, when you said the name, I was like, that name sounds so familiar. Where did, I'm like, oh, CUNY Grad Center. Yeah, okay. She's in the women's studies department there, I believe. So, she's a sociologist.
And I'm very jealous of you, too. You guys know who you're talking to at all times, and I space out so often.
This is one of those few times where I actually recognize someone's name. Most of the time, I'm just like, who? Anyway, so...
Well, no, you're very good with names, Chloe.
Oh, yeah, right. I'm going to ask a question now. We've been talking for about 45 minutes. If you subtract all the time from all the times I've said weird stuff and Val's got to edit it out. So one thing that I think is unique about this book is the way it ends. And mm-hmm. we'll put spoiler warnings, I guess, at the beginning of this interview so that people are surprised by this and that we don't ruin the surprise. But there's the choice. You have the choice of two endings, as well as there's the third ending that you give out as a bonus if you subscribe to your mailing list. And I read through all three. I don't know if that's what you recommend. First of all, I'm curious if you, one, do you recommend that people just pick one ending and stick to it? Is that like your intended idea? But then also, I've recently become a big fan of the idea of, I believe the term is ergodic literature, which is the idea that there are some books where some effort is required to read the text beyond just going to the next page. And so, you know, ergodic literature exists on a spectrum where, like, you know, like, this, I think, would probably be on kind of...
I know what book you're talking about.
I'm talking, yeah, House of Leaves. But this is definitely on kind of the lower end of the spectrum where it's, you know, there's two, possibly three endings, depending on how you got them to choose from. You know, obviously something like a visual novel that you play on your Switch or something would be like a very, you know, very high, you know, like so many different ways to traverse the text. And then there's other books like House of Leaves, where the text is deliberately obscured. And I was just wondering, what made you think, like, I need to have multiple endings? And then...
So the choice for the multiple endings is one I made at the beginning of trying to structure this novel. I really felt I could not possibly write a love triangle without giving the choice, because it's part of what people hate about love triangles, not having their favorite being picked. And, you know, obviously I used to play a lot of RPGs, like BioWare games, and Life is Strange made me cry.
Oh my
for 2 weeks.
That was how Val and I became friends.
Yeah. It's such a beautiful game.
Yeah.
It's so good.
It's so good. It frustrated me to no end.
Yep.
Yeah, beautiful game. So obviously, you know, I really feel like when you have that slight sense of control as the player character, it increases your buy-in with the narrative and the characters, and you feel more intensely about it. At least I do feel more intensely about it. I very rarely cry over books, but I will cry over video games where I have choices and I feel guilt. So I just wanted to have that a little bit. And the fact that the Bolam ending, you have to skip to it if you want to read it. You know, you have to do a little bit of work to get to that ending. Mm-hmm. That was intentional. But whether people read all the endings or none of them or one of them, you know, that's out of my hands. I really believe that people, you know, the reader-text relationship is sacred and I have no control over that. So, yes.
My follow-up question is, like, do you have a favorite ending yourself? Like, is there one that you would pick if you, like if this were Life is Strange and you had to choose Bay or Bay, which one, do you have a choice for the ending?
Well, the third ending, Save Yourself, is my original ending, but it's so depressing.
It is super hard. Depressing.
It's really hard to get through, but... It's the one where Genchu has the most agency, even though she uses it terribly and you kind of scream at her, don't do that the whole time. It's really rough. I don't know if I can live with that entirely. I guess the Choose Verity is my classic ending, but when I hear Emily Wuzella voice the audiobook, I really find it hard not to choose Bella.
Interesting. Yeah,
she does it so beautifully. I'm horrified by all the words I put into the mouths of my audiobook narrators, both Emily and Osa Ava Kane, who did my Hades book. They're so professional and they've done such a great job, but I feel a little guilty.
You definitely shouldn't. I think I'm one of the people who actually, like, I just stick with the choice I make in a lot of games, you know, choose your own sort of books, things like that. So I went with Polem, and I don't know if I'll read the other two. I feel like that
you haven't read them? Oh, wow.
No, I...
You have such good self-control. Okay.
I'm curious, but I found that even... So I can't replay Life is Strange.
Yeah.
I just, like, I've tried starting it, but I just don't want to. I think my brain kind of like shuts it down, and I live with the choices I make. And this is just my very, very subtle way of asking you what choice you made in Life is Strange.
Oh, dear. So my wife and I are playing it together the whole way through, but she had the controls at the end, so she chose to save Chloe.
What would you have chosen?
Oh, it's something we kind of fight about, because I feel narratively the game is pushing you to not save Chloe. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did, but I did cry about it for 2 weeks after, and I don't think it probably wasn't the right choice, because I was very upset about it.
I also chose to save Arcadia Bay and not Chloe Bay. So I respect your choice, and I think you're right.
I disagree, but sure. I don't know. It's one of those times where I feel like the story was pushing me so hard to one choice that I took the other choice just to spite it.
Well, I also love Victoria.
Yeah, right.
It was very easy for me.
Yeah. Right, because Val likes the mean girl, so...
But I think mostly it was just about, I think Life is Strange for me was a story about thinking that you have the control over something and in the end knowing that you don't, which the limitations of that game really piss me off most of the times, but I've learned to make those flaws into storytelling tools so that I don't stay mad at it forever. So I'm actually... I don't know how the other two endings play out, but I really kind of like the one that I read, because in the end, they kind of get what they longed for, right? Because Paul Lam wants a boring life, and that's kind of what we get. And I was just curious, maybe this is a question for both of you, do the other endings ramp up instead of calming down?
Well, I'm not sure about...
I'm just laughing because I'm just like, oh my god, I don't even know how to explain these endings to Val.
Well, they're both horror endings, I guess. This is why,
yes,
I don't call this book a romance personally, just because only one ending is kind of romantic. The other two are definitely not romantic. I mean, obviously the Choose Verity one is where Polem dies and Verity does not, and the Save Yourself ending is the sort of the bad ending in the video game where, you know, rocks fall, everyone dies, but worse.
It's so much worse. It's reminds me a lot of, Val, you've played the new Tomb Raiders. You've played the first one, right? Where, like, there's a lot of quick time events, and if you screw them up, like, lots of really awful things happen to Lara Croft. Okay. Like there's a lot of very gruesome things, and that is the Save Yourself ending.
Oh my gosh, I should have chosen that one, maybe.
Uh-oh. Interesting. Now I'm selling Val, because Val loves a bad ending too, so
I unfortunately do. It's a curse.
Or okay, have you played Disco Elysium?
I've told you the... Oh yeah, that's not for me.
That's not for
you. That's not for me.
I think we might have opened it once that we couldn't get into it.
Okay, fair. I mean, I think it is.
It's a lot of reading.
It's and it's a very specific style, I think, as well. Like, either you love it or hate it, that kind of, I don't know what to describe. It's this very, like, deadpan noir, but, mm-hmm. like, with a Greek chorus of emotions that are roiling around in the head of this sad old man that you play as. And that can be, that is a very specific niche of things. But I just remember that, like, the way Val played the game and the way it ended for her feels...
All right, that's 20 minutes in, bullied by a child.
Yeah, she got bullied to death by a child 20 minutes literally. Into the game. And that's Val's entire experience with the game. So that's just what I'm thinking about now. Anyway, but this is supposed to be an interview. We're supposed to ask you questions, not talk about our experiences with video games.
That's pretty hilarious.
Yes.
I make very interesting choices in a lot of media that lets me do that. I know that we've reached the one hour mark.
Yeah.
So I just want to give you the floor a little bit. Is there anything that we didn't ask that you're dying to talk about?
Oh, always a good question.
Oh, look, I think we've really covered a lot. I don't think there's anything else I need to say
This is your space. Yes,
this is your space. But I'm curious to follow up and say, like, do you have anything that you're working on that you want to give us a hint about, maybe?
Oh, sure. Well, just one thing about this text is, you know, I always try to make people aware of the content warnings, and there are extended ones on my website, lanyutan.com. So, you know, if that's something you want to check out before picking up the text, I always recommend doing that. I am working on some more fantasy books at the moment, but I probably won't be writing in the dark romance space or the romance horror space for a while, because they'll burn out by that. So
fair.
Yeah, but people can catch up with me by subscribing to my mailing list. Just go to lianyuntan.com. There's a bunch of links. And that's the best way to hear about my upcoming work.
Great. Thank you so much. And thank you for being here with us. We really appreciate it. And thank you for sharing your book with us. I loved it. I had a lot of fun reading it. And yeah, I'm so glad that I got the opportunity to read this and to talk about it with you. So thank you again so much. Val, any final thoughts?
I really like that both questions that I asked when I asked Chloe a personal compliment question and when I asked you like a question that gave you the space, you both immediately changed topics. And I just want everyone to be aware of that.
Okay.
And all of us to sit in that thought.
Okay. Thanks, Val. Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. Chloe, we have a bunch of stuff.
I'm going to plug our social media real quick. We have a Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. It is @InMediaLez on all of those. We have a subreddit. It's r/InMediaLez. Our Tumblr is...
thepodinmedialez.tumblr.com.
Our website is inmedialez.com. You can email us at inmedialez@gmail.com. And you can join our Discord. The link is in the description. Come hang out. Right now we are talking about Atomic Blonde, which was our previous episode, and people have thoughts on it. Which I'm curious to hear what those thoughts are. And do you just want to mention your website one more time?
Oh, yeah. It's lanyutan.com.
Great. And thank you all so much for joining us. And thank you so much for being here, Lianyu, for this amazing interview.
Thank you, Chloe. Yeah, thank you, Val.
And we'll see you in the next one.
I'm not going to say my normal line. That feels weird.
'Hey everybody, thank you for listening, and please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss new episodes. Also, it helps us grow, and we appreciate every single one of you who follows. And if you like us, tell a friend. Just be like, hey, these two lesbians are talking about other lesbians, gays, non-binary folk, and really queer people. Once again, thanks for listening, and we really appreciate you.